Hello, I'm Will Stein, and welcome to Geography Island Jams. This podcast is in the same style as the BBC Radio 4 Desert Island Disc series, whereby each episode I ask my interviewee what 8 songs, book, and luxury item they would want to take with them if they were stranded on a desert island. For rights reasons, the music has not been included in the podcast. You can find links to the 8 songs on the LSE Geography and Environment website. I hope you enjoy. Welcome to Geography Island Jams. My guest today is Neil Lee. Neil is an Associate Professor of Economic Geography at the LSE. He's also a Director of the Master's Programme Local Economic Development and the Undergraduate Programme Geography with Economics. He holds a PhD in Economic Geography. Neil's research revolves around cities, economic change, and the social dimensions of innovation. He has a particular interest in the distribution of the proceeds of growth and the links between innovation and inequality. Some other fun facts about Neil include, he was born in Chester, but he grew up in Oxford. He has spent a lot of time in Kuwait alongside Professor Simona Iamorino. He is the chair of the policy committee for the Regional Studies Association, and he met one of his best friends at the LSE Geography with Economics Open Day back in 1999. To start, I just want to clarify, you said you met one of your best friends at the LSE Geography with Economics Open Day, even though you ended up doing your undergraduate at UCL?
Yeah, so I had the choice between going to either UCL or LSE, and I went to UCL, which was great because I met my wife there and stuff like that, but I always slightly regretted not going to LSE because of the sort of vibrancy of the environment and the sort of, you know, reputation of the place. So, you know, while I'm really pleased that I made this friend and we got very close at UCL, it was great for me that I came back to LSE, which is now my home.
So when did you first start thinking about pursuing geography as a discipline?
So I wasn't particularly academic at school, and I remember finding, you know, I'm one of those people who can really only focus on stuff if I'm really interested in it. And it was when I was doing my GCSEs, I did geography and I did economics, and suddenly I loved it. You know, it sort of changed the way that I looked at the world, and it changed the way that I thought about academic research. And suddenly, you know, so basically then I decided that I wanted to do geography, and I couldn't really sort of get away from it. And there's another story here, right, which is that I actually originally was going to read economics and politics at uni, and because I have a brother and he was a geographer, and I didn't want to do the same thing as him. And eventually I found my way back into geography. There was no escape from geography, just because I think it's the best, most interesting way of understanding the world.
Any things you remember most prominently from your time studying at UCL?
So I really enjoyed... So one of the things I remember really well is they took us from UCL, there was an economic geography course, only one economic geography course, and they took us as a group to go to LSE to hear Michael Storper speak. And Michael Storper's like this, you know, he's a very famous academic and a very... He's sort of intimidating. He's like 6'7", and he's a sort of really intimidating guy. And I remember we all came to sort of packed lecture theatre at LSE to hear him give a public lecture. And I remember thinking, oh, you know, what a sort of incredible guy, these sort of incredible academics. And now he's one of my colleagues, and he's one of the nicest people you'll ever meet. So it all goes to show.
Can you tell me about the first song you'll be taking with you?
Yeah, so my first song, Common People by Pulp. First of all, I think this is a great song, but it's quite interesting about, you know, partly because it's about the university experience, so this is something which has become quite important to me and sort of mixing with different people. But it's also a song about inequality, and obviously a lot of my research is about inequality, so I really like this song because of some of the themes and the issues it raises about sort of, you know, the nature of risk and so on.
You've spent a lot of time at LSE over the years. Do you have any favourite experiences in that time?
Okay, so I've had loads of like good, fun intellectual experiences, interesting seminars, great lectures and stuff like that. But I have to say that the highlights I've had have, you know, often been the sort of social stuff which happens afterwards. When I was doing my PhD, we had a brilliant night in George IV. During the Olympics, must have been 2008, and it was a load of the professors sort of just having a chat, a really good chat about the sort of you know, what the politics of the day and what was going to happen with the financial crisis and stuff like that. And I remember that really vividly because it was just a really fantastic intellectual experience. So stuff like that, some of the stuff which happens around lectures, I think is often the most fun, the most interesting.
Do you have a favourite LSE building?
So I actually really like the old building. So there's a sort of room in the old building, which is where we hold loads of sort of social events and stuff, called the senior common room and the senior dining room, or staff dining room actually, rather than senior. And these are really nice buildings to be in because they kind of feel a little bit, they remind me of the sort of history of the LSE. You know, they're a bit older, they're not particularly functional anymore, but you can have really good lunch there. And there's also a sort of little place where you can read the newspapers and it just feels like you're in the 1920s. And, you know, you'll be surrounded by old professors and, you know, the coffee staff all know your name. And I really like that. I think it's nice to have a place and to work at a place where you have a staff coffee bar where you can sort of sit, where it's socially acceptable to sit back and read the newspapers. I think that's a really healthy for the culture of the place.
And I think it sort of links into what you just said, but do you have a favourite LSE meal or place to eat on campus?
Oh, so, I mean, I really like, so I quite like the staff canteen because I have a lot of nice colleagues and it's quite nice to sort of, you know, it's quite nice to bump into them. But actually my favourite place, I don't know if it quite counts on campus, but I really like having a cup of coffee watching the tennis players in Lincoln's Inn Fields. So there's a, you know, coffee shop, as you know, in Lincoln's Inn Fields. And you can sort of sit there, watch people play tennis in the sun, discuss research. And I think I really like that place. It's a lovely, lovely spot. And not that many people know about it.
I think, is it 25% discount if you're LSE?
I didn't know that.
Did you not?
Really?
Yeah, I can't believe it. Being your favourite place. Yeah, you just flash your LSE card, you get either 15 or 25% off.
What's it called? It's called Fields, right? Fields Cafe, yeah. It's really lovely. I just love sitting there and you sort of... It seems that you can often get seats and you can look out and watch people play tennis. And it feels like a proper university.
Can you now tell me about your second song?
So my second song is Metamorphosis by Philip Glass. And look, my main memory for choosing this is because I really miss my office. And when I'm doing work in my office, I always feel like I have to have some sort of fairly metronomic music on, because it helps me concentrate, it helps me sort of blur out the building work. So I always put on this song. And it's kind of, you know, it feels a bit dark, but it just really helps me work.
Before coming full-time at LSE, you worked at the Work Foundation as head of socioeconomic research. Can you tell me what the Work Foundation does and some of the things you did whilst you were there?
So the Work Foundation's when I worked there, it was a think tank. So we did research on sort of innovation, sort of high-tech city economies. I did research on the changing world of work, and I did research on, I guess, disadvantage, poverty, disadvantage. So it was a think tank. And it was great place to work and great place to work before joining academia, because you got huge amounts of responsibility very quickly. You got pretty quickly put in front of TV cameras and on the radio in some sort of quite high profile slots. And I'm not saying that I was always brilliant, but it's quite useful to get that experience in before you become an academic. Most important thing for me is that it teaches you first of all how to influence the policy process, and second of all it teaches you how to communicate policy a little bit, or to policymakers. So it was a really great experience for me.
So then after the Work Foundation, you became a professor at the LSE. What is it you enjoy most about lecturing?
So I love my job. I love the autonomy. I love the fact you get, you know, within confines, but you get a fair amount of autonomy to research things which you think are important. And then you get to sort of communicate leading edge research with, actually, we have really good students. You probably don't realize this at the LSE, you know, because you studied there, you probably take it for granted. But LSE students are really good. They're bright. And that's one of the reasons why it's such an interesting place to work, because, you know, you get to, you know, quite often, actually, I was on a call just before this where I was talking with an Indian student, and we're doing some work about sort of the tech economy in India, and she knows loads about it, and she was, you know, having good old debate about it, you know, what about this, what about that, and that's really, really nice, having those sort of debates at the LSE. I mean, the other thing is that, you know, it helps, it's in the middle of London, it's nice to feel like you're part of the centre of things. I mean, it's a unique institution. I feel very lucky to be working there.
And do you have any fun stories from your time being a lecturer?
Yeah, so I can give you some of the most embarrassing stories. So the most embarrassing story I had was when I turned up for a lecture an hour early, and it was the first lecture of the course, and I phoned up my mate, Ricardo Crescenzi, who's a professor in the department. I said, "Ricardo, where are all the students? Am I in the wrong room?" And he was like, "Neil, read the timetable again." And I just misread the timetable. So, you know, that sort of thing happens all the time. I'm sure I've done some really, really bad lectures. I've done lectures where we have not been able to get the Zoom to work, and we've had sort of poor guest speakers who can't hear anything we're saying, and it looks like they're speaking to a sort of empty room. Done all sorts of stuff like that. Basically, if there's a mistake to be made in higher education, I've tended to make it.
And can you now tell me about the third song you'll be taking with you?
So my third song is Mr. Brightside by The Killers, and I have a really specific reason for choosing this, which is that it was a really popular song when I was doing my master's degree. And one of the things I remember was for 1 year or 2 years, there was a tradition that you would hand in your dissertation, and immediately after handing your dissertation, you go to the pub, and then you go from the pub to a club or whatever, and you'd hang out in London, and you'd go have dinner or whatever it was, and then you would end up and you would see the sunrise on Primrose Hill, which is a really nice tradition. And when we did this, one of my mates on the course, who's a guy called Travis, he managed to miss his, he's a very bright guy, but we had such a good night, he managed to miss his flight back to the US because we had so much fun. And anyway, so every year I tell the local economic development students that this should be the tradition, and every year they ignore me and go for a nice sedate meal and that sort of thing. So I'm choosing this song to remind me of like one of the few interesting things I did in my youth.
So one of your interests is the links between innovation and poverty. Can you explain why they might be linked and how policies can help increase the rate of innovation?
So we've got the two of the big agendas in public policy, I guess, around the world at the moment. First of all, is how you can sort of create high-tech economies, right? How you can grow the sort of innovative part of your economy. So if you look somewhere like London, you know, they're trying very hard to grow everything from sort of fintech to, you know, digital economy in Shoreditch and so on. But at the same time, there is big concern about high levels of poverty and disadvantage, and particularly high levels of inequality. So one of the things we see is that, you know, across most of the OECD, the sort of club of rich countries, across most of those countries, there has been an increase in inequality. And, you know, certainly over the last sort of 30 or 40 years. So basically what I try and do in my research is say, right, say you are attracting Google to your local economy. Say you're attracting the headquarters of Amazon. What's that going to mean for people who are in the low-wage labour market? Because I think we shouldn't just care about people who've got good degrees from places like LSE. I think we should be caring much more about people who are on low income, who have fewer qualifications, because basically the economy has pushed away from these people over the last 20 or 30 years. You know, it's been harder to be in this group. It used to be you could get a job in a factory. That is no longer, you know, there's still some jobs, I don't want to sort of overstate it, but actually a lot of the sort of good jobs for low wage workers are not there anymore. And we need to think much more. We need to think much more imaginatively and much more systematically about how we link this sort of growing tech economy with people who are sort of relatively disadvantaged. You look at Silicon Valley, right? We know Silicon Valley is just like, you know, everyone says like the most incredible place on earth, and it's creating all these innovations and changing the world and all that sort of stuff. And you go there, and there's people living in tent cities and people living in doorways, and inequalities, you know, pretty tough. And, you know, even people who work for big tech companies often can't afford housing. And so I'm interested in those issues. Like, you know, we've got to do these things to try and stimulate the, you know, innovative, the high tech economy. The question is how we make sure that it benefits everyone. And that's the thing which other people just aren't answering.
So one of your previous papers was about the Northern Powerhouse. Can you tell me what is meant by the Northern Powerhouse and how might better connections between the northern cities help them grow better and compete with London?
Yeah, so the Northern Powerhouse, basically, there's different ways of thinking about it. So for some people, it's a strategy. It's a way of thinking about how you might rejuvenate the north of England. So we have this north-south divide in the UK, is where the south is on average, you know, richer, at least in terms of productivity and higher wages, and the north is less so. And so this has been a sort of continual concern of policymakers. It's a big concern at the moment, or at least it was until coronavirus. And the Northern Powerhouse, basically, it was, you know, put out there by a guy called George Osborne, who used to be Chancellor of the Exchequer, and he basically said, right, we're going to have this Northern Powerhouse. It's going to be like a sort of area of the north where we sort of focus investment, and we're going to have more science and more technology and better transport links and stuff like that. And the aim was to sort of rebalance the economy. And of course, politically, it's pretty difficult to do that, right? So you start off by having this investment focused in Manchester, saying you're going to do stuff for the north, and then North Wales wanted a piece in, and then they weren't sure whether it should be in the northeast of England as well, and of course they had to be included. And then people in the Midlands said, hey, hang on, you're giving all this extra money to the north, why can't we have some? And you had this next initiative called the Midlands Engine, and so on and so on. So you started off with this thing which, you know, maybe an element of strategy about it, but now it's like just a really powerful brand. I mean, you know, I work in the field of economic development, and relatively few people, you know, it's not like I go to dinner parties and people say, oh, how fascinating what you're talking about. But the Northern Powerhouse people actually care about, and people understand, you know, people have an opinion about it. So it's become this quite powerful brand. And for the government, they want to say they're doing stuff in the Northern Powerhouse because it's fuzzy, and everyone in the north, you know, well, not everyone in the north, but lots of people in the north think that the Northern Powerhouse is about them. Although really it's sort of fuzzy, it's not really, we don't really know where it starts and ends. It's a sort of become this complicated piece of policy making rather than something something strategic. So that's what the Northern Powerhouse is about.
Can you now tell me about the fourth song you'll be taking with you?
So this is George Ezra Shotgun. And I'm choosing this exclusive, not because I like it particularly, but exclusively because every morning at the moment, it is lockdown at the moment. My kids do Joe Wicks every morning, and I've started doing it with them and quite enjoying it. And yeah, so this song is always seems to be played like all the time. Every morning we seem to get this song. So I thought I'd give people one more opportunity to hear it.
So the next question is about Kuwait. Can you tell me more about your time in Kuwait and what is it you were doing there?
So I got a grant with a professor in the department called Simona Imerino to do some research on R&D investment in Kuwait. And Kuwait is a really interesting place, like really interesting, because they have this completely unique political economy. And so what we wanted to look at was R&D investment, so investments in research and development. You know, if you draw a graph and you say you have GDP on one axis and R&D investments per capita on the other, then you basically have a pretty straight line. You know, it's a pretty good relationship between these two. Richer places tend to have more R&D, with the exception of the Gulf states. So we thought, right, what Kuwait needs to do is they need to increase their R&D investment, increase their private sector R&D investment. That's what needs to happen. And so we went there, we've been there twice, we've done lots of interviews, focus groups, loads of data analysis, big survey of Kuwaiti firms. You know, really, really interesting. And we basically came to the conclusion that we were probably wrong. And actually, they don't need just to invest in R&D. What they need, first of all, is education. Because if you have R&D with no skills, you know, if you just... It would be very easy for a country like Kuwait, which has a lot of money, to just invest money in, you know, shiny new science infrastructure, but nobody would have any way of dealing with it. They'd be investigating the wrong things. There'd be all sorts of sort of incentive problems there. So really it's been really interesting, because it's kind of changed my view on economic development, because it's much more of a sort of co-evolutionary process. You cannot just invest in science and technology. You have to have the institutions and the sort of background characteristics as well to make sure that it translates to growth. And this is interesting because it's a story we see in Kuwait. It's also a story we see, you know, in the UK as well. You know, we have this big strategy at the moment to try and increase R&D investments. The question is, do we have the institutions to deal with it? And do we, you know, is that just going to be wasted money?
So now, Neil, can you tell me about your fifth song?
So my fifth song is Sunshine on Leith by The Proclaimers. And I'm choosing this exclusively because my wife is from that part of Edinburgh. And she said I had to choose a song about her. And I quite like Sunshine on Leith, because if you go and watch Hibernian play, who are a Scottish football club, they will sing Sunshine on Leith, and it's brilliant. It's like You'll Never Walk Alone, but sort of, you know, I'd say even better. So I'm going for that. I think it's a great song.
It is clear you're very well travelled. Do you have a favourite place in the world that you've been to?
So I think we are really lucky in Europe, actually. So, you know, I'd say in Europe, I think we're really... So the Netherlands, I love the Netherlands. Like, what a country. The people are just hilarious. It's well run. It's a nice place to be. I actually think it's quite beautiful. You tell this to anyone Dutch and they go, oh, no, you know. What about sort of, you know, what about somewhere more ostensibly beautiful? But I know, I think that the Netherlands is really, really awesome. And outside of Europe, I go with Lebanon. I think Lebanon's an awesome place as well for very different reasons. So the Netherlands is like well run and organized, and you go to the Lebanon and it is just completely the opposite. It's like poorly run. It's completely chaotic. But it's very beautiful. But the people are also, you know, very funny and good fun. And yeah, those are my two favorite places, if I'm allowed to have two.
So my next question is there anywhere in the world you're most keen to travel to?
Yeah, so I really want to spend some time in India. So I've been to India and, you know, I loved it, but I've never done any sort of research there, and it's quite, you know, it's hard. You don't want to do, India or China, both the two places I really want to. And just working, one of the nice things about LSE is that you get to work with people who are from places you wouldn't necessarily consider going to. So like, you know, I have a student from Hyderabad, and now I just really want to do it. I want to go there. And I have a really good PhD student who's from Shenzhen, and he basically, before lockdown, he lent me a couple of books about Chinese history, and now I just want to go to China. Just want to go and see what it's like, and, you know, talk to people and find out about the place.
Do you have a favorite meal or a favorite dish?
I like curry. Just generally, I'm not that fussy. I like most British people, I like a good curry and a couple of pints on a Friday night.
So you spent most of your childhood growing up in Oxford. Do you have any favourite stories or memories from that time?
I have a brilliant one which tells you about the next story, which is when I was growing up, we had a family friend who lived in a house in like a, you know, slightly cooler part of Oxford to the suburbs we lived in. And she used to look after our dog. And we had this amazing dog, and she'd take our dog in the holidays. And her next door neighbours got quite friendly with this dog. And so what we would have would be, you know, we'd go away, and then her next door neighbour would take our dogs for walks. And then the next door neighbour is turned out to be Radiohead. And so my next song is Creep by Radiohead, because we had this period when, yeah, Radiohead used to walk my dog. And that's still nothing's going to top that in my life, right? So I'm going with Creep by Radiohead as my next song, please.
So yeah, is that your song number six?
Yes, I'll switch it. Song number six. Creep by Radiohead.
Do you have any pet peeves? Anything which annoys you way more than anything else?
So I've got one. Literally my most middle-aged man thing is that I really hate people idling their engines. And it's because so many of our colleagues, like people like Seffi and Tom, do these incredible studies about air pollution. And then you walk down the street and there's people just sitting there in their cars with their engines running. And it just really, and like, you know, because my colleagues do these fantastic studies, it sort of freaks me out now. You know, I'm like, what are you doing to everyone's air? So that really gets me. That's my sort of pet peeve.
What about when you're having a bad day, is there anything you do especially to make yourself feel better?
I don't know, I always do exercise, basically. I always try and do, if I'm in a bad mood, my like wife pushes me out the door in running shoes, tells me to come back when I'm in a better mood, basically. I'm not that sort of generally quite a, you know, cheerful person, but yeah, definitely exercise. It's exactly, you know, if I'm in a really bad mood and the weather is appropriate, we have a outdoor swimming pool near us and I'll just be told to go off there for an hour and just go for a swim, because exercise is just so good for you, and it's the only thing which gets me out of bad moods, really.
So now we're moving on to song number seven.
So song number seven, I'm going with Boy with the Arab Strap by Belle and Sebastian. And my reason for this is that it's just the best music to run to. It's like cheerful, and like, it's locked down, like many people I've been doing. You know, try the only way to get out your house is to go and do exercise. So I've been just going running and running to this because it's a great song.
If you were given a magic wand, is there anything you would change about the world?
So look, I think now, right, with the coronavirus crisis, it's quite a good moment to think about, you know, what you would keep and what you wouldn't keep. And I really, really love it without cars. Like, there's so many fewer cars around here, and that's brilliant. And also, you know, fewer aeroplanes. I think, you know, that's probably, obviously there are some big, big factors underpinning this, and it's, you know, we wouldn't have this set of circumstances by choice, but I'd do something about that. I think, I mean, given the audience of this, I would say my magic wand, I would use it and I would make everyone come to office hours. That would be what I would use for my magic wand. If I was the sort of dictator, I would make office hours compulsory, and I would mean that I'd have students queuing out the door with intelligent questions they had cribbed from reading academic work. That's what I'd like.
What's your favourite part of being at the LSE?
I don't know, it sounds like a cliche, but I love the feeling that you're somewhere where you can think about stuff and it matters. I really like that. That, you know, we're really privileged that we it's somewhere where you have these sort of seminar discussions, and they're not just seminar discussions because people are actually going out there and changing the real world. And I love that. And I love it that it's so international as well. I think it's great that, you know, you have these students who are, you know, civil servants from the sort of Philippines or South Korea, and they come over here and they, you know, discuss stuff and they head back and it'll change what happens. And I really like that. It's not just, we literally work in an ivory tower, me and you, Will. I mean, it's an ivory painted tower, but it's not in that, you know, what we do really matters. And I really like that.
Can you now tell me about your eighth and final song?
So I'm going with Holocene by Bon Iver, which is just a really nice, I mean, it's a really nice song. I thought it was a good way to end it. I like it a lot. I had a really nice couple of years ago. I went to stay with a friend in Dublin, and we sat in his back room, which just backs onto a park where Bon Iver was playing a concert. And we, you know, had some nice sort of Irish beer, and we listened to this concert from his back room, and it was just fantastic. And yeah, so it's a great song. I think it's a nice way to finish.
You're allowed to take with you the Bible, the beverage report, and a book of your choice.
I was going to choose the beverage report, but now I can't.
Was that your book?
No, of course not, but you know. I'm sure for some of my colleagues it would be.
So what book would you take with you?
So I'm going to take Alan Clark's diaries. And the reason for that is that these are, like, so Alan Clark, this is a very British choice, but Alan Clark was a very controversial, slightly unpleasant politician in the 1980s and 1990s. And he was famous because he lived a sort of, you know, he was like a cad. He was not, his behaviour I would not condone in any way at all. But the thing I really like about this is it's kind of like a parabola of this guy's life from sort of, you know, late middle age onwards, and that he talks about, he's very candid about what happens to him, what he does, and he's very candid. But the thing I like about it most is that he talks a lot about what matters. You know, he's so frustrated by spending time doing things which doesn't matter when he could be spending time with his family or doing, you know, the sort of research which really works for him and so on. And because of that, you know, I love reading these books. I could read them, you know, they're funny, they're offensive, they're awful in lots of ways, but you know, they really, you know, you can read them again and again. And I think it would be great to be stuck on a desert island. And, you know, no matter how bad things got, at least you're not Alan Clark. At least you don't hold those opinions.
Finally, what is the luxury item you'll be taking with you?
I was really torn between a wind-up radio so that I could listen to cricket and a crate of single malt whiskey, of good single malt whiskey or something like that. But I think I'm going to go with the wind-up radio, because I think I would feel completely isolated if I wasn't able to listen to cricket and able to listen to the news and a bit of music. I think I'd be really in trouble.
Well, I hate to break it to you, but you're not allowed to take anything with you which gives you external contact to the outside world. So I think that sort of made the decision for you. It looks like you're taking the crate of malt whiskey.
It's a good second choice.
Well, Neil, thank you very much for telling me about your Geography Island jams.
Thanks, Will.